this man will never, ever make a captain of an aircraft. He will always need the supervision of a captain. And single seat is out of the question. On short finals at Yeovilton, the engine stopped. And it was quite a shock. Suddenly, it was like flying into treacle. That's the only way that I could describe it.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended. Extended. It's time to talk aviation.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 141 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Today, I'm joined by Ellie Carter. Ellie is a private pilot with tailwheel and aerobatic endorsements. She's a STEM ambassador and chairperson of the Light Aircraft Association's Youth Education Support Group. Ellie, it's good to have you back. How are you?
It's great to be back. I'm really, really good, thank you.
And I saw you went flying today.
Yes, it's kind of been tricky in the past few months because one of the aircraft has been having maintenance done to it. But I got up in a Cub for the second time in the past week or so, and it was amazing. You can't really beat a Cub.
No, good. Good to see you back up in the air. And our guest today has a career that spans flying the mighty Harrier in the RAF to displaying his unique RV7. The flying cow at air shows. Somewhere in there is an ejection from the Harrier as well. Jerry Humphreys, welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much, Peter and Ellie. It's delightful to be here. Thank you.
It's great to have you on the show, Jerry. You came to us through a good listener of the show, Kieran Murphy. So we're grateful to Kieran for introducing us. I didn't know too much about your story, but having looked you up a bit, it's a fascinating journey that you've had throughout this career. Where did your interest in aviation start?
That's a good question, because it started before I remember my mum, who is 96 and lives with us here, and her mind is very good still. She tells me that I started flying the day I was born, because my dad, who was a Second World War pilot in the RAF, flew me around the room as an infant, a few hours old. She said, and you never stopped since. She always says that when I first learned to draw, it was always planes and, model Airfix kits, model balsa wood planes. It was just an obsession that started from before my earliest memories were the very first day I went to school. I remember seeing a picture of an airport and an aeroplane on the wall. That's all I remember. So I guess I'm an aviation geek. It's been an obsession, which I've had the privilege to be able to, turn into a career.
And you mentioned your father there. Can we have a little chat about him? Because actually, he's got a fascinating flying career in his own right, hasn't he?
He does. And I'm very interested to know how you know that, because
my research, Jerry,
completely predates anything to do with social media, and I suspect there's very little about him anywhere on the internet. But yeah, he was from Southern Ireland, as I am, and his first cousin went to join the RAF during the Second World War, leaving some very humble background in this part of the world, and I think went to Belfast and a recruiting officer there. Got into the RAF and started learning to fly. And my dad followed him. Sadly, my second cousin once removed or something like that, was killed in a Spitfire accident and is buried near in Yorkshire. I found his grave. But my dad survived and went on to have a very interesting career. And I figured it out, went through his logbook, and by the time he was 21, he had soloed a Spitfire, a Hurricane, and a Typhoon, one of the most powerful single-engine machines of the Second World War, all before he was 21, which was quite extraordinary, but I guess quite normal for those days. He then went on to fly Mosquitoes. He was in at the very end of the Second World War, so didn't see any operational flying, and I suspect the chopping and changing of OCUs was to do with, you know, at the time there would have been a lot of change going on. But he left at the end of the war, and then he rejoined a few years afterwards and went to fly Mosquitoes with 41 Squadron in the Far East, doing photo reconnaissance stuff over Southeast Asia. And that was a very interesting time in the Malayan emergency. And his logbook is full of sorties called Fire Dogs, which were basically photo reconnaissance stuff over Indochina and Borneo, and lots of the Malayan emergency was a sort of low-level war that went on for quite a few years. I'm not a great history buff, but he did a lot of that sort of flying. And interestingly, actually, when I years later went to join the RAF, my very first operational Harrier sim instructor was a chap called Chick Kirkham, who some listeners may have heard of. But Chick was a bit of a legend in the RAF. And he took one look at me and said, "Humphreys from Ireland." He said, "Was your father in the RAF?" And I said, "Yes." So I flew Mosquitoes with your dad. And so he took me home and showed me photographs of my dad with, you know, somebody who was not my mother on his knee in the sergeant's mess in Changi all those years before, and photographs of him and my dad. And they were very good friends, as it happened. And my dad was alive at the time, because I didn't actually know my dad was a pilot until I was about 7 and found some photographs in a drawer. And it was quite a shock to me to find that he was, in fact, a pilot and had flown as well as all his RAF stuff. He then got into early helicopter flying, and he was doing surveys in North African desert, in Libya and in Egypt. And they were surveying for oil and lifting mines. And, you know, there were all sorts of interesting. I think he had 3 engine failures. He was flying Franklin engined Bell 47Gs, early sort of the MASH helicopter, sort of like a goldfish bowl on the end of a crane, that sort of thing, if that's a visual description. But yeah, he did, I think, about 2,000 hours in those. But it was hard flying and hard living. And then at the end of it all, he got left a farm by an uncle in Ireland. He had saved some money up, and his uncle, during that time, times were bad in Ireland, and his uncle couldn't afford to keep cattle on the farm. And so the government at the time were going to take the farm off him and give him land bonds and divide it among, I don't know, somebody else. There was something very nasty going on. My father lent his uncle the money to stock the farm. And so when his uncle died, he left my dad the farm. And so that's where we live today. And that's where I was born. And my father never, ever looked at an airplane as long as he lived again. He became a farmer and totally changed career. And and as I say, it was a shock for me to find out he was. I think he was very proud of the fact that I got a scholarship and joined the RAF and all that sort of stuff. Yeah. But to my dying regret, I have very few regrets. Or one of my regrets is that we never flew together. Yeah, I'd love to have flown with him, but he's around still. I can feel his presence. Yeah.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. Yeah, I picked up some bits and pieces about him and most of the stories you relayed there. I also picked up a story about him flying a Mosquito over his home village of Cappamore as well.
That's right. Yeah, that's a bit of fun. That's a story where it's funny, I kept getting reminded of it by old ladies saying, "I hope you're not coming around here like your father did in 1940, whatever it was. And I failed to find that entry in his logbook, but I suspect for obvious reasons. But yeah, I've narrowed it down. My son and I have actually found a map recently, which I suspect is the map that he used, because there's a line that goes from somewhere around where he was based. I think it was somewhere near Bryce, and he was doing the Mosquito OCU, and he and his navigator decided to go off on a long cross country, and I suspect their compass must have been 180 out or something, a bit like wrong way Corrigan. And they came over Capamore, but the local village here, which was an old coaching stop where there were three houses at a crossroads and all three were pubs. And of course, you know, he had a bet with his navigator and said to him, I'll show you a village where every house in the village is a pub. And, you know, of course, he knew he was going to win the bet, but it was a bit of fun.
Okay. Wow. There's got to be a book in there, Jerry, somewhere. There's got to be a book.
Somebody
in there.
Said that to me recently. And you know where that, you know what? I think there's a book in everyone. But in my case, that's where it's staying.
Okay, well, let's talk about your introduction to aviation. You started off by going to Queen's University Belfast to earn
your wins. I think I started, I reckon I started before that, because I probably learned more about aviation and structures and engines and aerodynamics from model flying. So if there are any aero modelers out there, then to me, that is an absolutely superb way of getting into flying and understanding about all the technology and all of the things that go into making an aircraft flying. And it doesn't have to be a very expensive, highfalutin, radio-controlled, modern piece of kit. Obviously, there are wonderful pieces of gear around at the moment, like drones and stuff. But even the more basic aircraft model, balsa wood, tissue paper stuff, the traditional construction techniques are a great way to get into flying and structures and, you know, the whole of the whole scene. And that's where I learned most stuff from. And, of course, it's people that encourage you. And, you know, the people who the local model flying club took me under their wing and gave me their secondhand engines or their old models or the, you know, I remember a single channel radio set, which was, if anybody knows, a bang bang escapement with a rubber band driving making the motor power to power a rudder and only a rudder. And, you know, there was lots of fun and lots of good times there. But yes, as soon as I finished school, my mum wanted me to be a doctor, I suspect, but that was never going to happen. All I wanted to do was to go flying, but they insisted that I had to do something academic before I went flying. So I thought, right, I didn't tell them, but I went and I reckoned the only place in Ireland that you could have anything to do with flying or there was anything that was remotely appealing was Belfast, Queen's University, in the middle of the Troubles. Of course, Southern Ireland was a bit like living in Kent. It was completely apart from the Troubles. They were all up there. But to my mother's absolute horror, I announced that I had a place at Queen's University in Belfast. This was 1975. And I got my way. I was dropped off and, I had an absolute ball for 3 years. Of course, day one at university, there was a big sign at Freshers Week saying free flying for students. And basically, I wasn't leaving till I joined. There was no way that I was passing that sign without getting in, which, of course, caused quite a stir because being who I was and where I was from at the time caused a lot of raised eyebrows. We couldn't possibly have someone from Southern Ireland join the Queen's University Air Squadron. But I think they saw that this was somebody who was enthusiastic and would put something in. So eventually I got in security clearances. I guess my father, having been in the same organization, might have helped somewhere or other. But that was great. And
Jerry, just to interrupt you there. Coming from Southern Ireland, then to be fair, I don't understand the dynamics at play here. How do you get into the RAF? What gives residents the
That's right. The opportunity? At the time, If you were from Southern Ireland, you could join any of the UK armed forces.
Okay.
Then I think the RAF stopped taking people from Southern Ireland soon after I joined, but you could join the British Army because many of the British Army regiments had close connections, the Connacht Rangers, a bunch of Fusiliers. There have been traditionally a lot of close contact connections between the British forces and people from Southern Ireland. Naturally enough, it's a very sensitive topic in Northern Ireland, and it was the sort of thing that I would have probably not advertised too much while we were there. And of course, we used to go on summer camps, and we would go to somewhere like, say, West Raynham or Swinderby or somewhere like that. And because we were from Northern Ireland, we were expressly forbidden to have the standard military haircuts. We actually had to grow our hair long, as it was the fashion at the time. Yeah. And we looked ridiculous as a group of people in our RAF volunteer reserve uniforms going around with girly haircuts, sort of long hair. And there are some hilarious photographs of the Queen's University Air Squadron, gang at summer camp, all with hairs down to their shoulders or whatever. And you can see fuming warrant officers and apoplectic, people around the place who were the regulars. Yeah. But, we used to get away with it.
I could see that coming from I'm not in the military, but my family's from the Navy. I just couldn't see how that would happen, and I could imagine an awful lot of ribbing towards the Air Force as a result, using that as an excuse. But moving on with your training, you then went to officer training at Cranwell.
Yeah, we did. We flew Bulldogs. I just missed out on the Chipmunk at Queen's UAS. And so at the end of my time at Queen's, my last year at Queen's, I became somehow, I can't imagine how, but I became an overseas student, politics. But my fees went up by about times, I don't know how much. And I thought, well, I was fortunate I got a scholarship. And so the RAF said they'd pay for me at university. And so in my last year, I was paid as a pilot officer, and then moved from UAS. I had a PPL at that stage, and then went on to Cranwell to do IOT, initial officer training, and then on to flying training. The IOT thing was great fun. I think I was quite a bit younger than my peers and probably far less mature than them and worldly wise. So I ended up always in trouble, or always being the one that was caught, or always being the one who's, far too naive to keep quiet about something, but eventually I got through the system.
I'm understanding why Kieran suggested we have a chat now. So tell us about some of that, those early aircraft that you migrated onto, Provosts and
sure. Hawks. When we started at Cranwell, after IOT, initial officer training, which was the usual square bashing and running around with packs on your back. And I was pretty fit, and I was young, and I had lots of enthusiasm. But the great thing about Cranwell was every time we were marching around the far side of the road over at the airfield, you could see these jet Provosts whizzing around. And every now and again, when things were down, I would say to guys, look, it's all going to be worth it. Just one more month of this, and we'll be over there. And it was always my the end goal. So yeah, we went across the road and we flew, to start with, the Jet Provost Mark V, which was a quite advanced airplane to jump straight into, because most of the gang that I was with, we'd all been to UAS and we all had done what was called a PFB, the preliminary flying badge. So we were at, I guess we had about 140 or 150 hours of Bulldog flying, which was concentrated, very high quality training, all by professional RAF instructors, A2s, A1s. And so we jumped into the pressurized two-seat side-by-side jet military trainer, which was a wonderful, wonderful airplane. And from there, I actually then went sort of sideways to Church Fenton. There were a few incidents, shall we say, And it's funny, actually, because somebody decided, well, put it this way, the feeling was mutual, but we didn't get on. One of my instructors and I did not get on. And I think he decided I was far too young and far too cocky, and I needed to be taken down a peg or two, and decided that also he wrote, I knew this because on my dining out and out from the RAF, he actually wrote in my 5000 series, which is the sort of the book that goes with you all the way through your career.
Okay.
This man will never, ever make a captain of an aircraft. He will always need the supervision of a captain. And single seat is out of the question. And I thought, oh, my God, I didn't realize he was quite so, shall we say, against me. But anyway, yeah. I was sent off to do multi-engine training at Finningley. And I was crestfallen, absolutely. My world just fell apart because everybody's brainwashed into thinking that, you know, single seat fast jet is the only way to go.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. All okay. Flying is wonderful flying. I then went to Church Fenton and resolved to be a good boy and not get in trouble too late at night time and stuff like that. And I decided that, I met a guy called Les Hatcher, who was known as Snatch. He had an Alsatian, and that Alsatian bit anybody that it didn't like. He was an ex-Lightning guy who I suspect was terribly frustrated being sent to be a basic QFI at a training school, and he really was still a Lightning pilot at heart. So I was sort of, he was my primary instructor to do 15 hours of NDB holds and instrument flying, and he looked at me and said, right, we've got to do 15 hours of refresher flying before you go on to Finningley. What do you want to do? And I said, well, to be perfectly honest, sir, I'd like to do low-level aerobatics and formation for 15 hours, but, you know, whatever you want to do. And he said, I'm the station display pilot and I haven't got enough hours to practice my routine. He said, I'll tell you what we'll do, he said. We'll go up, we'll practice my routine, and we'll come back and do an ILS at the end. Is that okay? And I went, perfect. So he did his routine and he said, would you like to have a go? And so I did his routine. And at the end of it, he came down and he said, why are you going to Metz? And I said, well, you know, there were a few incidents in the bar and I think, you know, I got in trouble. And he said, right, let's do another trip. I did another trip. And then I was called to see the station commander. I thought, oh, my God, what have I done now? And the station commander took me in his office and said, right, we've decided to take a chance on you. If you don't come first on every single course that you ever do from now to the time you die, I will personally come and kick you in the behind. Is that understood? I went, yes, sir. And it was wonderful. Somebody believed in me and I thought, right, I'm going to do this. And so I came first in every bloody course I could possibly do from then on because these guys had given me a chance.
Yeah, and, it's amazing, isn't it?
It was great.
Yeah, when things like that come across your path and change your journey.
Yeah, and it really, I needed a wake-up call because I was sort of, you know, resting on my laurels or my enthusiasm, and I could see that, you know, this stuff wasn't hard for me. This was easy. This was something I was born to do, but I was having far too good a time. I was only 19. I was 20. I was finished university at 19, so I was really a lot younger than the others. And the other thing, of course, that some of the other guys didn't like was that we got what we called green shield stamp flight lieutenant rank. So I was a flight lieutenant at 20, being paid far too much and having far too good a time. Anyway, long story short, I went to Valley and had a great time at Valley on the Hawk.
Did you know that the first G suit for British pilots was essentially a chest-high pair of fisherman's waders which were filled with 2 gallons of water? The water automatically squeezed the pilot's legs as positive G was applied. Did you also know that the Islamic Republic of Iran Air Force's oldest McDonnell Douglas F4D Phantom is set to clock up more than 70 years in service, having been delivered in 1968 and now subject to life extension programs taking it to 2040? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
I volunteered for, or asked for, the very last Hunter course at Lossiemouth. So I did tactical weapons unit on the Hunter, which was absolute heaven. Flying a 1950s/60s single-seat jet fighter and learning how to do all the operational things like air-to-air combat, air-to-ground stuff, air-to-air firing, everything. Just absolutely wonderful.
And Jerry, everyone who we've talked to who's flown the Hunter has said what a beautiful aircraft it was. What did you think of it?
You've got it in one. It was a magnificent machine. And in fact, I was very fortunate because I did well in that course. And, you know, those who did well usually got the choice of where they wanted to go. And at the time, everybody was being, you know, one is brainwashed. One is not brainwashed, I suppose. One is driven by what is deemed to be what the best. There's so much competition in the military. Everybody is, you know, between badges and rank and who's done what. And, in the big scheme of things afterwards, of course, it's all a hill of beans. It matters absolutely nothing whether somebody's flown a Hercules or a VC-10 or whatever it is. But at the time, it seems so important. But at the time, I went on, before I went to the Harrier, I had what I thought was the absolute best job in the world. I was a Hunter ferry pilot at Kemble, where the Red Arrows were. And a guy called Mike Lawrence, bless him, Mike was such a good guy. Me and my best mate, Brian Weatherly, were sent to hold for 4 months in Kemble. Brian ferried Hawks and JPs, and I just ferried Hunters. And I managed to be able to fly every single mark of Hunter that still existed in the inventory of the Navy and the RAF at the time. Wow. So I have all the Hunter marks in my logbook, and that was absolutely fantastic. And the stuff we got up to unsupervised as young whippersnappers was just, I don't think the statute of limitations is over on some of that stuff we did yet, even to this day, 35, 40 years later. But yeah, that was fun. And then the Harrier OCU came, and Brian and I and, you know, a few other guys, we went on the course. And that was the beginning of a huge adventure on to Gütersloh in Germany in the Cold War days. Learning to fly the Harrier was, again, great fun, very demanding, very, very competitive. And, you know, one was, I think, the overriding sort of memory of all of my privileged career, if you like, in the RAF, is the people that you meet. And especially, you know, when the Harrier Force especially was known by those who were not in the Harrier Force as the Harrier Mafia. Because, you know, it was very much a, you know, if you knew somebody, for example, if you wanted to get in the Red Arrows, at one stage the Red Arrows was all Harrier guys. But it was, you know, there were some wonderfully talented guys there who had, you know, great drive and real, you know, talent. It was fun. So off we
Jerry,
went.
Jerry, just that point you made about converting to the Harrier. You've talked about some of the wonderful aircraft you flew and how, if you don't mind me saying, you were quite a natural pilot. It flowed quite easily. The Harrier is a very different proposition. How did you find that transition?
I don't think any airplane's hard to fly because if it was, the test pilots wouldn't pass it. Once you're trained, all airplanes are easy to fly. So you just need to learn the systems and you need to learn the techniques of using the aircraft. What's difficult is operating the aircraft, so interacting with air traffic or the sort of pressure that one puts oneself under if one's a private pilot or in the military, you're flying fast, you're flying low, in formation, in poor weather, trying to find a plank over a stream in the middle of a forest sort of thing. So, you know, the difficulty comes with workload.
Right.
And that's where you have to learn to prioritize correctly. You have to learn to be able to compartmentalize, I think. I think my wife, Vicky, who was in the RAF herself, she knows me so well by now, but she knows that if I'm on the phone, if I'm doing something, don't bother talking, because I will totally ignore. I have a way of just cutting stuff out. So that's a technique, I suppose, that you sort of pick up along the way. So you have to just prioritize. And it's, you know, the standard priority is aviate, navigate, communicate. We teach that to kids these days. And it's, you know, fly the plane, point the plane, talk about it, you know. And, you know, that's a thing, and you have to.
You're one of the very few pilots who've got over 2,500 hours in the Harrier. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, that's right. I was fortunate to get a lot of flying in through
that's
my career.
That's a monumental number of hours on the Harrier. We'd just never see anything like that again,
most of the flights we did were 40 minutes long. But wow. There was a massive amount of planning and briefing went in beforehand, especially later on when we started flying at nighttime with night vision goggles and thermal imaging and stuff. Those were the early days. You see, flying around Germany was Cold War stuff in the early version, which had a not particularly accurate inertial navigation system. And it had a moving map. But again, you'd be lucky if the moving map was within 2 miles or 3 miles, something like that. You'd be updating it now and again. Yeah. But when we started flying in the dark, we realized we couldn't use a standard handheld map. The map was really a last resort. But so everything had to be programmed into the kit. And so, you know, we had an upfront controller. We'd manually punch every single waypoint, all the digits in. This was pre-digital computing and planning. We had Scion organizers, which converted OSGB into WGS84, if anybody knows anything about nav stuff. You know, we were transforming waypoints into satellite speak waypoints and then manually loading them into the aircraft for every flight that we did. So that was, the workload involved there before the flight was huge. Wow. But there was lots to do before you went flying. But in a way, it's good to brief carefully beforehand because, you know, the flying's the easy bit then.
yeah, of course. What models of Harrier were you flying then?
All of them, I guess. I didn't fly the very early Mark 1, but the GR3 was the ground attack reconnaissance aircraft. I flew that on 3 Squadron, which was primarily ground attack. And then I moved across the airfield at Gutterslow to 4 Squadron, which was primarily low-level recce. And so the subtle difference there was that we would normally fly on 3 Squadron. We flew in pairs or 4 ships or sometimes 8 ships. In 4 Squadron, we were usually alone, unarmed and unafraid, in that we had a recce pod. And we'd whiz off and try and do some bit like a scout or, you know, somebody, avant-garde, just go ahead, try and figure out where. And of course, 4 Squadron was known as 4AC, Army Cooperation Squadron. And that's where I really understood that everything that you do in the air supports, you know, you can never win a war by flying over saying, this is my piece of air. You have to win it by standing on the ground and saying, this is my piece of ground. And it's very interesting looking at what's going on in Ukraine at the moment, of course, where you know, there's a lot of talk about no-fly zones, and I suspect there's a de facto no-fly zone in the west part of Ukraine. But what really happens is, you know, who stands on a piece of ground and controls that piece of ground? And so the Harrier was very much an army cooperation airplane. We did a lot of stuff with forward air controllers, with special forces. But the recce business was fascinating because you had to learn a whole new set of techniques of recognizing armored vehicles. And even to this day, it's great fun. I can still see, oh my goodness, that's a BMP, that's a T-62. I know the types of tanks because that's what we learned all those years ago, and they haven't changed that much.
Wow.
It was fun.
Now let me take you back to our good friend Chick.
Because
you're featured in the book Harrier Boys 2, I think it was. Tell us that story about the abort with Chick.
Oh yeah, that's right. It was the very last flight that I did on number 3 Squadron before I transferred across the road to 4 Squadron, and it was Chick's last day in the Air Force, more or less. And somebody decided it would be good to get SSVC, I think it was the Forces Television people involved, and do a little bit of media stuff. And so I'd been in the cabin for the week. It was a big exercise, and I hadn't actually flown all that week, but I had walked the strip every single day, and I knew every inch of that strip. And when it came to fly with Chick, there was lots of, you know, cameras and photos and, oh, the light's not right, and we need you to pose here. And eventually we went to go flying. And I remember at the time it was a short strip, and we were in a two-seater which had been defueled. And as we barreled off down the runway, as soon as the engine reached full power, I realized something wasn't quite right. And you instantly think, what have I done wrong? And at this stage, I had actually done something wrong. I'd forgotten to turn on the water switch. We used to inject pure demineralized water into the back of the engine to cool the turbine down so we could put more fuel and get more power out. And I'd forgotten to turn the blooming water on. And at that moment, I thought, okay, if I just flick the water on, it'll be fine. And I went to flick the water on, and it was the only airplane in the whole fleet where they had a new mod on, where they had switched the taken the water switch was normally on the right side of the cockpit, and they'd put it over left above the throttle where you could flick it up with your thumb. And right. In my went to turn the water, they'd moved it. Where's it gone? At that stage, I realized if I turn the water on now, it's going to be too late, and this is going to hurt. Because, you know, we needed the power from the beginning of the takeoff run to make this 747 feet long strip with zero. That the abort was appalling. There was a big ditch at the end of the strip, so a Harrier sized hole which would have taken us and gobbled us up. So I'd sort of a briefed Chick beforehand that, you know, Chick, if we have to eject here, if we have to abort, it's going to we're going to have to jump out. Because the abort is no good. Yeah. So at that moment, my mind went into sort of hyperdrive, and I thought the little plan in the back of my head, which I thought I'd never briefed to anybody else, but I would probably do this. I chopped the HP cock, put the nozzles down, and just concentrated completely on a gap, which I knew to be 1.5 feet wider than the Harrier, and shot through this gap doing about 70 knots, came to rest with the engine stopped in a very rough, cloudy field. And never forget, I just said, Chick, do not eject. I have a plan. And cool as a cucumber, he said nothing. He didn't pull the handle, thank goodness. And I'll never forget that moment where there was a total silence as I could hear the Harrier engine whining down, and that the fan blades made a certain sort of clanking noise as the engine wound down. And I opened the lid of the two-seater. I said, Chick, put your pins in. And I thought, I'm in serious trouble here now. But I don't think we've broken anything. And then at that moment, the system sort of pulled their jaws off the floor, shall we say, and the firemen and the ambulances all came screaming around the corner, and, you know, everybody was going, what was that? So yeah, that was an exciting moment, but my fault. But Chick was as cool as a cucumber, and he's just like he was no different to what he was in the simulator. He was very good.
Yeah, but it happened for real on June 17th, 1986. Talk us through what happened on that day.
Yeah, that was not long after that. After I joined Force Squadron, we on June the 16th. Let me take you back a day. On the 16th, Brian, my pal Brian Weatherly, and I got engaged. Both of us, not to each other, but to two girls, two separate girls. And the next day, I had a very important training mission to fly four airplanes over Vicky's parade ground. She was in the RAF and she was at Locking. And so we had a tanker somewhere off the southwest coast, and we were going to tank there. We were going to do a simulated attack, and then we're going to whiz past Locking and then fly back to Goodislow. And on the tanker, I got a generator failure. And that meant I had to land near a suitable airfield, blow the gear down, land within 5 minutes, blah, blah, blah. So on short finals at Yeovilton, the engine stopped. Totally unconnected, nothing whatsoever to do with my generator failure. And it was quite a shock. Suddenly, it was like flying into treacle. That's the only way that I could describe it. And Chick's training came out straight away. I literally just grabbed the handle and pulled it. I'd just come off a combat survival rescue course as well. So I was fairly up to speed with, you know, dropping the pack and all of the mechanisms that went on. And I'd really carefully looked at all this business. But anyway, pulled the handle and life went into slow motion. You get a thing called temporal distortions when you have a massive pump of adrenaline like that. And I remember the smell. Most of all, I remember the smell of cordite, and my clothes stank of it afterwards. And there was a bang, an enormous boot up behind. And I remember seeing the plane just fall away from me. And as I left, I had the impression that the engine started to wind up again as well. I went, oh my goodness, I've done something wrong. And I jumped out too soon. And I'm going to be in so much trouble because I haven't hit the manual fuel. I haven't dumped the tanks. I've done absolutely zero emergency drills. I just, you know, like a coward, pulled the handle and I jumped out. And I thought, oh my goodness, I'm in so much trouble here. And dropped the pack, stood up, and then I looked up and thought, oh, not just now am I in so much trouble, I've also killed about five people here, because there were three cars waiting to cross the runway. There was a runway caravan with a guy in there and his binoculars, whose jaw was on the floor, I suspect. And there were five guys with plastic bags doing a fog plot on the airfield. And the mirror image of that was just black wreckage, smoke, flames, bits of Harrier all the way through. To a massive big fireball and black smoke coming out everywhere. And I saw, oh, my heart just dropped. Fortunately, nobody was injured. Nobody was hurt. There was no one on the other side. Had it gone the other way, it would have been terrible. So, and then 24 hours, a completely sleepless night. I think it's the only time I've ever been given something to make me sleep, but it still didn't work. The boys came in. Of course, one's peers did the boards of inquiry. So it was Ian McDonald, I think it was, one of the lads came in and said, Jerry, you're off the hook. We found the problem. Thank you.
And Jerry, you said the aircraft went away. Did the aircraft literally drop? You were very close to the runway, weren't you?
Yeah. I was about 100 feet, I'd say, above the runway. But as you know, your head is forced down into your chest. And you're supposed to close your eyes, but I remember... I didn't for some reason. I remember looking down and thinking, seeing the plane fall away. And it hit the ground. Well, see, what happens when the engine stops, the nose drops straight away and the airplane slows down. So it's an instantaneous thing. I had a 0.6 of a second parachute ride, I'm told, and I was right on the edge of the
wow.
seat the parameters. Wow. And so I was lucky to get away with it. But the reason I got away with it actually was partly because of Chick, but also I'd seen an ejection when I was on the Hunter. I was just getting out of a Hunter one day and one flew over. In fact, it was Dougie Marr, who a very famous guy who's been in the Red Arrows. He's look him up. He's there's some interesting stories about Dougie. But anyway, he turned downwind and what looked like a stream of smoke or vapor or something out the back of his airplane. And at about 100 feet, his canopy came off. I thought, that's really, my goodness, he's lost his canopy. And then the seat fired and what I thought was a drogue parachute came out and there was a sack of potatoes lied, you know, literally less than 100 yards from me. So I ran very fast towards this, what I thought was, you know, him in his immersion suit having expired and thinking, what am I going to do here? I thought, you know, say a prayer in his ear. I don't know what I was going to do. And then he stood up. Oh, my God, he's not dead. Couldn't believe it. And he said to me, Jerry, good to see you, he said. Now, the only reason I'm standing here talking to you is I got that nose up before I pulled the handle. And there's a good lesson for you. My God,
wow.
This guy is giving me a flying lesson just having got away with by the skin of his teeth. But he's absolutely 100% right because, you know, a year, two, 3 years later, I was in the very same situation. And, that was drilled into us that you didn't hang about. If you had a serious issue like that, you didn't get two chances at it. You just went for it.
Yeah.
So, thanks to Dougie Marr and Chick.
Wow. What was the cause of the engine failure?
They think that a circlip had been incorrectly fitted, possibly in the factory many years beforehand, painted over. And so, you know, a circlip sits inside a slot and it wasn't quite properly seated, and it worked its way out. And just at that moment came out, and high pressure fuel was pumped into the engine compartment instead of into the engine, which meant that the engine wound down.
Wow. Gosh. And to you, no injuries at all?
No, a few scratches and a few, that was it. Nothing serious. I did probably hurt my back, but I wasn't going to tell anybody about it.
God, you're such a pilot.
No way was I admitting to anything like that. But years and years and years later, after I left the Air Force and started pulling calves out of cows and stuff, it got really bad. And I ended up having discs taken out, and I suspect probably didn't do any good. But yeah, I mean, I lasted 25 years before I had to do anything about it.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Thanks for sharing that, Jerry. Really appreciate that. I want to move on to what you're doing more recently. But just before we leave your RAF service, you left as a squadron leader?
That's right. I did. I'd had a lot of fun. I did a PR job with my wife doing school's presentation team, which was, I suppose, covert recruiting, really, but it was under the Director of Public Relations. But I was fortunate because at that time, we had no two-seaters and we had no simulators, and we were really short of experienced Harrier guys. And number one squadron, which I was on, had been on, had no weapons instructor. So I made a deal with the boss at the time. I said, "Boss, if I can get away and stay current, will you keep me on as a sort of, we used to call them Kevs, or, you know, as a sort of supernumerary spare pilot?" And he said, "Absolutely." So Vicky, during my whole ground tour, she did the admin. And anytime we weren't presenting on schools, universities, that sort of stuff, I'd whiz back to one squadron and stayed current. So I managed to get about 180 hours in my 3-year ground tour and stay combat ready and do a red flag on one squadron.
Wow.
I think when the Director of Public Relations found out, he wasn't very happy.
I bet not.
He said, "Who have you been working for all these years?"
Okay.
But that combined with Spanish Air Force Staff College was a lot of interesting fun was had there as well. I had to go and learn Spanish for 6 months. That was my job. And then came back from that. And then I went into DPR. Oh, sorry, I went into OR, which was fascinating. My last job was looking after future technology for cockpits. So I was involved in NVGs, digital maps, displays, symbology design. I was the sort of Ministry of Defense guy supervising research on stuff that I now use today, or we all take for granted every day. But this was 30-odd years ago. And so we're looking at, you know, digital maps, whether they were raster, whether they were vector charts, learning about human factors, learning about, I used to call them my jelly heads, these people with PhDs in whether the, you know, what symbology shapes we have, that sort of stuff. It was great fun. And then left the RAF and went farming for a couple of years.
Yeah, you couldn't let go of the bug though, could you? And you set about building this RV7.
Yeah, there's a film, an old Kevin Costner, I'm not a baseball fan, but there's a Kevin Costner baseball movie called The Field of Dreams. And the strap line of the movie is, "If you build it, they will come." And this had always been in the back of my mind that I was going to have an airstrip. And so soon after we came home, I did a bit of building for my mom to live next door, and she's still here, she's still alive. But the next major project was to knock a hedge and shift some gravel from one part of the farm to a very wet part of the farm. The locals thought I was absolutely crazy ripping up all this good land. But yeah, I put about a 500 meter strip in. And then a mate of mine, Steve Johnson, Joss, who's a very good guy, he's an ex-Red Arrows guy, he used to fly with Nigel Lamb, and he now is the chief pilot for Ultimate High. But Joss got in touch and said, "Hey, Hum, Here you've got a grass strip in Ireland. He was at the time flying for the old Flying Machine Company, and Sarah was running it at the time. Her dad and her brother sadly passed away, but they had Nigel Lamb, who I knew, Nigel, Lee Proudfoot, John Romaine, and they all came across with Second World War fighters, and they needed my strip extended. So the film company paid for the strip to be extended. So I now have 700 meters instead of the original 500 that I had, paid for by the most appalling film. But if you look it up, it's fine. It's on YouTube. It's called Waiting for Dublin. And it was a sort of, yeah, I guess it was a sort of romantic comedy. But the flying scenes were fantastic. Lee Proudfoot, Nigel Lamb, John Romaine, all flying camo, sort of disguised, a P-40 and a Harvard. Great fun. So yeah, that was the airfield.
Ellie, do you fly from a rough strip, do you not?
Yeah, I fly from a tiny strip, which is 270 metres long, which is
is small.
Yeah, farm strip flying is incredible, and it's certainly a skill.
Yeah. Our local flying club is Kuna, and that's where I taught my son to fly. It's 400 metres, 416 metres, I think it is, and metres wide, tarmac. It's sort of generally, you know, anybody who doesn't fly from Buckingham, for you, it's Heathrow. But most people consider it to be, most people think it's a bowling alley, you know, then that's a model airplane strip. Where's the real airport, you know? But Ellie, I'm impressed. For 200 metres, that's pretty cool. Yeah, very good.
Yeah, we'll send you some links of Ellie flying, actually.
Oh, God.
But the RV7, how long did it take you to build?
Yeah, the RV7 was an interesting one. I got involved in the local flying club here, and I'd never done any flying instruction in the RAF. It was always weapons or survival or electronic warfare, all that sort of stuff. The pure flying instruction came after I left the RAF. And one was able to learn to be a flying instructor at the club. And while I was there, I discovered that my father had learned to be a flying instructor at the same club. And that he was the first guy to get his Class 2 restricted flying instructor's rating. And I was the very last one, because they changed the system in the JAA. You were no longer able to do it at what we call a DTO then. It now has to be an ATO. So there was another interesting little full circle going around there. I became a flying instructor and absolutely loved it, flying small planes, mostly rallies. And eventually Harry, my son, learned to fly. But at the club, there was an accident, an unfortunate accident, but fortunately nobody was hurt. But one of our rallies had an accident and ended up at a field where the aircraft was written off, but the engine was absolutely perfect. It had just come back from a factory rebuild at Lycoming's. And I knew that this engine would probably be, you know, the insurance company just wanted to get rid of the wreckage. So I made an offer and it was accepted. And so I put the engine, filled it up with oil, turned it upside down because the camshaft's on the top of the engine, and put it in a box insulated with a wardrobe heater, plugged it in and left it alone. And thought, right, that's a really good engine. Now I've got to try and figure out what I'm going to put on it. And so did a lot of research. And a pal of mine that had been flying with me, a guy called John Alsford and another chap called Jerry Parr, had just finished an RV6. And it was the very first RV6 in the UK to go flying, as far as I know. And it was the early days of those. So I rang John up and he said, yep, best thing since sliced bread. It feels like a Harrier. It's the best machine you could possibly have. It's fantastic. It does all the right stuff. So I thought, yep, that's the machine.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
So I ordered the kit, an RV7, I sold a couple of plots on the edge of the farm to pay where they were to finish off the house building we were doing, but one of them was actually to buy an airplane. Vicky knows that now, so say it. So 5 years later, I always say it kept me out of trouble for 5 years. It's been getting me into trouble ever since.
How in goodness name did you find the time to build an aeroplane at the same time as run a farm?
Well, didn't have far to go because it was in the shed. It was right next door. I don't watch television. I didn't go drinking to the pub. You know, Vicky's great. She, you know, she's single-handedly brought the kids up and all that sort of stuff. But no, it was great. And I always said it was a bit like eating an elephant, one small piece at a time. And when it's done, it's done, and that's it. So, you know, it was. There were times when one has deadlines or whatever, but you have to step back and go, hang on, this is supposed to be fun, this is recreation, this is great. And it was a learning experience, a step up from model airplanes and aeronautical engineering at Queen's, but it just was a very natural next step and learning. I've had a few moments where you think you know it and you get humbled. One of my first moments like that was, I remember one weekend going gliding at Goodislow. And, one is a fighter pilot flying single seat, low level, fast jets, blah, blah, blah. And I thought, well, I'll just have a go at this gliding. So I went along to this gliding stuff. There's a lot of hanging about and gliding, and there's a lot of, talking about it. But the chaps there, I suddenly realized they knew more about real flying, thermals, wind, cloud. They knew pure flying more than the whole of the squadron put together. And of course, when I got up in this glider and realized this is the business, there's no engine. You are able to feel the air. You see birds flying with you. I was hooked. I thought, wow, this is fantastic. Now, I never had the chance to go back and do much gliding since, but that got me hooked in light airplanes. And then, the business of building an aeroplane. The other time I was humbled, let me just think about my train of thought being humbled. There's lots of aeroplanes are humbling, no matter how long you do them. They'll always bite you. Just when you think you know it all, you get humbled. Yeah. Anyway, yeah.
And it's a striking black and white colour scheme, and she's called the Flying Cow.
The colour scheme is an interesting story. I was involved. One of my duties was we always had to do a board of inquiry. The thing was, whenever there was an emergency, everybody rushed to the window because if you saw the accident, you couldn't be on the board of inquiry. So, you always tried to watch what was going on. But if you didn't see it, you weren't a witness, you could be there. So I was not a witness to a very tragic accident, which involved a mid-air collision between a Cessna and a Jaguar over Wales. But I ended up doing a lot of work with a chap called John Chapelow, who's an aviation psychologist. And we realized that, well, he knew this, but I sort of realized and then convinced the board that one doesn't see color, one sees contrast, and that an aircraft's color might be good for camouflaging it on the ground, but in the air, what you actually see is contrast. And so this is actually one of the reasons why the RAF trainers now were painted black. And we stopped painting our early Harriers were all dark green. But when we started flying over no-fly zones in northern Iraq, they painted them gray, sort of air defense gray, because, of course, the Harrier got very dirty in the field and the black from the engine covered the back end of the airplane. And so we were sticking out from the ground. We stood out like sore thumbs. Yeah. And so my airplane, when I built it, we couldn't decide what color scheme to have. And I thought, well, I'm going to take it apart and get it painted professionally by a friend of mine. And it's somewhere else. So I thought, if I fly it naked for 6 months or a year and then take it all apart and examine everything to make sure there's no surprises, then at that stage, we've 6 months to go for the color scheme. So it was a family competition, right? Somebody wanted black with flames. Somebody wanted pink with bows, etc. And one day flying along, I had an epiphany there was a herd of black and white cows. I saw them miles away. They stood out really well, and it just became so obvious, that's it. You see contrast, not colour. And I thought, right, yeah. I can't have a black funereal airplane because it'll take too much heat. The fuel will get vaporised, all that stuff. But black and white and living on a farm, Frisian cow, it's a no-brainer. And so that's it. Yeah, that's the story of the wow. black and white.
And you do displays and you do aerobatic type displays, but you're also, as you mentioned, a flight instructor, you're an examiner, and interestingly, I think it crept in there, you're chairman of the General Aviation Safety Council of Ireland.
Yes.
Is that a passion, a fascination, or a calling?
I think one year as lucky as I've used up all my lives. I've had 4 engine failures. I've had some very close shaves. My best pal, Brian, who I mentioned, was killed a week after my ejection. So, you know, I've had a charmed life. At one stage, 1 in 10 that learned to fly the Harrier was killed. 1 in 3 ejected. So, you know, I've been lucky. And flight safety has always been a very, you know, very hot topic, shall we say. And, you know, making things as safe as possible has always been something in the back of my mind that, you know, has been a real, you know, this is what's kept me alive. So, you know, all of the things that go into flight safety. And of course, in general aviation, flight safety sometimes is something that, you know, is not neglected, but takes a back seat. If you're in an organization like an airline or some sort of, you know, a commercial organization like a flying school or somebody that does maritime surveys or something, you have a system in place, has to be there with all of the supports for threat and error management, SMS, all that stuff. Whereas if you're flying in a small light aircraft, you don't have that much of a crutch or a support system, and it's really up to individuals. So I felt that in Ireland especially, there wasn't a very... There's lots of disparate groups, just like the GASC Go in the UK. And I know Mike O'Donoghue very well, and we work very closely together. And it was great. You know, there was a system where all the disparate groups involved in GA, you know yourself, between paramotors, model airplanes, up to people who fly. General aviation, as you know, isn't just recreational flying. It's also everything up to parachuting and SPO stuff. So, yeah, any organization, we all share the same sky, and any organization that helps to spread the word and promote and provide a way for people to either do some reporting or have a resource where you can see stuff about loss of control or strip flying or how to avoid mid-air collisions or, you know, the 101 topics there are, is good. And I'm passionate about that. And it really does, I think that's really, really important that we do that.
Ellie, you've just recently finished your aerobatic rating. Have you got any questions you'd maybe like to put to Jerry on that topic?
I have. So obviously, I've only flown one aerobatic aircraft, the Super Decathlon, and it's a really, really fun aircraft that you do have to fly. But I've also heard that and I've experienced it. It's actually quite a mundane aircraft in aerobatics. It doesn't really fall out of stuff. It's very nice to you. So what's the RV7 and aircraft that you've flown doing aerobatics like in comparison?
That's a good question. We used to have a decathlon at the school where we did aerobatics ratings and UPRT training. So I know the decathlon. It's a really, really good airplane. In fact, I think Patty Wagstaff uses it at the decathlon in her school as well. So it's a great airplane, and I wouldn't say it's a, you know, I'd rate the Decathlon as really, you know, but it's, of course, it's not one of the latest plastic fantastic airplanes, which will do, you know, mind-numbing rates of roll. The RV is more like the Decathlon than an extra. It's very nice. I think the RV flies more like a chipmunk than anything else I've flown, I think, and actually not unlike the Harrier in the feel, in roll, and the response in pitch. It's a very sensitive airplane. 2 fingers is all that's necessary, and it has to be flown all the time. But Yeah, it feels nice. It's a very responsive airplane. It's a very easy airplane to fly. But you like any tail dragger, it's not over till it's in the hangar. So it's a lovely little airplane. Yeah, I think you'll have to come and have a go. You'll enjoy it.
That would be amazing. Thank you so much.
I'm sure we can get Ellie over to see you at some time. You've done some flying across water, haven't you, Ellie?
Oh, I have. Yes, I flew to France in a Piper Cub. It was a long trip and a fairly long trip over the Channel.
Yeah, I'm across in the UK quite a bit as well. I'm in a group called the Air Squadron, or they're now called the Royal Air Squadron, and that's a bunch of fascinating people who are all passionate about flying, and we go on little tours every now and again, and some of them overseas. So if I'm over, I think we're going across next month. So I might look. I'll see if we can hook up.
That would be really, really awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, that'd be great, Jerry. Thanks for that. Jerry, one question that I've got loaded. I might steal Ellie's thunder here. Is what do you think makes a good aerobatic pilot?
Okay, I'm fortunate in that I know probably the best aerobatic pilots around, certainly in Ireland, Eddie Goggins, who's a fascinating character. In fact, you should probably get Eddie on your, you should have had Eddie on your show. Look, he's much better looking than me. But
you got a voice for radio, Jerry, don't worry.
I think what makes a good aerobatic pilot is somebody who's passionate, somebody who is methodical, somebody who, you know, aerobatics is very like dressage. And somebody once said, aerobatics, you fly, you spend a fortune to go somewhere and somebody tells you how badly you fly. So, you know, the marking system is very like dressage, where you start with 10 and people knock marks off for mistakes. And so you get, basically, you never get told how good you are. You always get told how bad you are. So you've got to have thick skin. You've got to also have a mind which is able to think ahead, because, you know, the known maneuvers or the unknown maneuvers, it's aerobatics is in the mind, especially competition aerobatics, is definitely a mental business, not just a physical business. Obviously, you've got to be able to maneuver the aircraft. But once you learn the basic skills, aerobatic competition flying is mental. It's all in your head. Obviously, lots and lots and lots of practice and tons of money if you want to do it at the very top level as well. But what makes a good aerobatic pilot? It's the same as what makes a good pilot. You got to want to do it. And that's always what I say to young people who want to get into flying. Anybody who wants to get into flying, I always say to them, if you want to do it, that's half the battle. Because there will always be a reason why you can't do something, or there will always be a hurdle, there'll always be a barrier. Money, obviously, is a big issue for a lot of people. Opportunity. But I've always said this, and I think this is always true. You just look at people. People are ordinary. Everybody's the same. You know, we're all human beings. We're all make mistakes. We're all flesh and blood. And you just got to look at that person and say, well, if he can do it, I can do it. You've got to believe in yourself. And that is so true. You got to just, you know, give yourself a break and soak everything up that you possibly can from the internet, from YouTube, from books, meeting people. And, you get there. And I think aerobatic pilots are a bit like that. There's obviously some are better than others, but it's not the physical polling that makes them good. What makes them really good, the top people, are artists. They're not flyers. There's more art than top aerobatic guys are. I think it's more, they have the same talents as top musicians, or I suspect a lot of, I don't play a musical instrument, but I suspect a lot of pals of mine who are really talented flyers are actually very good musicians as well.
Interesting. Ellie, just before we go then, any final questions for Jerry?
I don't actually think so.
Well, I've got a question for you then.
Oh,
Any plans to do any aerobatic competitions?
I would love to do aerobatic competitions. Actually, it's something that I've always really wanted to do. But again, it's finding somewhere I can do more advanced aerobatics. And since the decathlon has actually been offline for a while as well, I haven't done that much since. So I think I just need to get loads of experience, and maybe one day it might be okay.
Maybe one day. Okay, Jerry, we're running tight on time now, so
sure.
I'm just going to start reeling us in. I think we need to get you back. I think there's a lot of good stuff that we still need to talk about.
I've only barely scratched the surface. I mean, I haven't mentioned AFTA, where I teach, and we do aerobatics ratings, and we teach people, and you know, my son's starting with Ryanair on Monday morning, which is very exciting.
Wow. I didn't realise he'd got his commercial licence.
Harry flew with Norwegian for 3 years, and then COVID hit, so he's been at home fixing cars and filling my hangar with cars and all sorts of stuff, working in a garage. But he did an interview with Ryanair last week, and they said, can you start Monday? And he said, absolutely. I thought, great, he's off my books. Brilliant.
brilliant stuff. Brilliant. Oh, I'm really, really pleased about that. Jerry, whereabouts can we find you online?
If you Google my name, you'll see all sorts of horrible stuff. But none of it's true. You'll find me. I'm Gasky.ie. If you look up Gasky.ie, I run that. I run the Gasky website. You'll also find me on the Atlantic Flight Training Academy website. I'm the deputy head of training there. So you'll find a bit about me there and what we do and all the stuff that AFTA does. Apart from that, I'm not really a Facebook, Instagram, Twitter sort of online person, really.
Okay. Well,
I have to admit, I did listen to your podcast and thought, I'm a fraud. I can't go on this podcast. You've had on here before, but
it's been absolutely fascinating. Really, really enjoyed it. It's been a real insight, and I think there's a few more stories to come. So we will come back and ask you back on. I think we need to have a discussion. A bit more of a detailed discussion about general aviation, the state of general aviation.
That'd be nice.
In Ireland and in Europe generally. So let's do that.
It's a deal.
Okay. Well, that's it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon, as well as the wider extended family of supporters, including the aviation historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter, as well as Gareth and Tim on the extended Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. Ellie, where can we find you online?
So I'm on Facebook. It's Ellie Carter. I'm on Instagram, and that's at Ellie Carter 74, and Twitter, which is at DragonGirl94.
And as many of our listeners are now on the Spotify podcast app, please can you click on the ratings tab and give us one of those 5-star reviews. It's as easy as that. It's just one click. And while I'm at it, I just want to thank some of our listeners for leaving reviews for us. Richard9989 from the UK, Jofus Mac from the USA, Gerber Singh from the UK, Isaac ADA from the USA, EC from the UK, Tim and MXS Andy 12 from the USA. Thank you very much for all your very, very kind and generous reviews of the programme. And that's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Jerry Humphreys.
Goodbye to everybody, and thank you very much for having me.
And it's goodbye from Ellie Carter.
Goodbye, and thank you for having me too.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear.
the programmes produced with a Creative Commons licence.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taking me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Knowing how to recognise a store, being taught like visually and the basic PPL, it wouldn't bother me.
Thanks for listening to Extended. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.